bond of friendship between the two. And now, from the bottom step, she could hear the bespectacled boy, what was his name? Oh, yes, Fiddlesticks. Could hear Sticky, speaking like a scholar about some study he'd read, and she observed his friend, Rennie, listening with actual interest and understanding as he tied the cranky little girl's shoe for her. So charming was the scene that Miss Plug found it hard not to be distracted, which bothered her extremely, for Miss Plug was a dutiful guard, and her duty, as she understood it, was to look out for strangers, especially well-dressed men carrying briefcases, and for any activity that might be deemed suspicious. Her duty was not to gawk at this ponytailed girl training a bird of prey, or to eavesdrop on the brainy conversation of these two boys, all of which was certainly unusual activity, but none of it was suspicious. Miss Plug was used to unusual. This house was an unusual house, this job an unusual job. For one thing, she had been told almost nothing about the house's residents. Their occupations and histories were a mystery to her, as well as to most, if not quite all, of the other guards. According to Miss Plug's superiors, the guard's job was not to ask questions. Questions would be a waste of time, for most of the answers were highly classified and would not, therefore, be given. Miss Plug and the other guards had been told only that the house's occupants were important and that their importance was directly related to what was in the basement. As all the guards knew, what lay in the basement was a bank of large computers. The computers hummed almost imperceptibly, and night and day, week in and week out, they continued in their mysterious activity. Ceaseless, rapid, extraordinarily complex activity. Although the guards, most of them that is, had no way of knowing it, the computers were among the most powerful and complicated machines ever invented. They were unusual, in other words, and guarding them was part of Miss Plug's unusual job. The climate-controlled basement in which the computers were situated was inaccessible, except by way of a hidden stairway that originated inside the house. Once in a while, the guards had reason to descend briefly into the basement, but they were under strict orders never to touch the computers, or even to look at them too closely. These orders were hardly necessary. If an enormous monster had lain sleeping in that dimly lit basement, a creature far more powerful and intelligent than any of the guards, why, nothing on earth could have induced them to risk waking it, and their instinctive feeling about the computers was much the same. The only person who ever touched the computers was Mr. Benedict, whom Miss Plug, for her part, regarded as something like an amiable and perhaps half-foolish lion tamer entering the dreaded cage. The guards understood nothing of the workings and secret purposes of these computers. All they knew was that the computers served yet another machine, one that had come dangerously close to wreaking terrible havoc in the world, and that in the hands of the wrong person, it could do so again. They had no notion of what this other machine looked like, or what it did, but more than a few of them, including Miss Plug, imagined it as something huge, spidery, and sinister, with gleaming eyes and countless whirring blades, and a shrieking cry like the wail of a buzzsaw brought to metal. Indeed, they suspected its appearance was even more beastly and frightening than that. They suspected their imaginations were incapable of evoking the true horror of this unknown machine. They knew only that these computers were its heart and brain, which must, for some unfathomable reason, be protected and preserved, and that in a locked and guarded chamber on the third floor, hidden behind a decorative screen, was a curious chair, and that this chair, too, was somehow linked to the terrible machine. At least, this was what the guards thought they knew. The truth was that the chair was the machine itself. The guard's imaginations had reached in the wrong direction, a reasonable error, for their imaginations had little to guide them. The chair appeared simply to sit there, quiet and still, behind the decorative screen in that cozy chamber, doing nothing, threatening nothing. With its curious red helmet attached to the seat back, the chair resembled an old-fashioned hairdryer, an eccentric piece of furniture, certainly, but a harmless one. This was the Whisperer. And for the moment, in the hands of Mr. Benedict, the Whisperer was harmless. Indeed, under Mr. Benedict's care, the Whisperer had been made to seem as inoffensive as possible. It had even been made to do a certain amount of good. Unfortunately, despite Mr. Benedict's best efforts and intentions, the Whisperer was soon to pass from his care. When it did, the fates of a great many people would once again be pulled along behind it, like leaves trailing in the wake of a speeding vehicle. And the very first to be so affected, and among the most important, were these four children now enjoying the fresh air under the watchful eye of Miss Plug. Real and Official Matters. The rest of the winter passed more or less without incident. Sticky celebrated a housebound birthday, missing yet another optometrist appointment. The ever-exploring Kate discovered what she believed to be new nooks and crannies. She wasn't entirely sure she knew what a cranny was. Rennie learned a new chess opening and tried parting his hair on the opposite side. And Constance completed an epic poem about pig drool. But none of these events counted as news, exactly. At least not the sort the children so earnestly wished for. There had been no word on Mr. Curtin's whereabouts. No hint of progress in the authorities' search. Nor were there any developments on the home front. For when the children had approached Mr. Benedict about Mr. Bain's suspicious absences, he had said they were quite right to wonder about it, but that he would be imprudent to speak of it further. And so they were left to speculate not only about Mr. Bain, but also about Mr. Benedict's reasons for maintaining silence on the matter. Speculating grows wearisome eventually, however, and even secret society meetings lose appeal when there's nothing new to discuss, especially when the members have already spent too much time together. Time passed slowly for the children, therefore, with lessons every weekday, endless rounds of board games and cards, and never a foot set off the property, until one day, just as spring was mustering itself for another appearance, something finally happened. The day began normally enough with newspapers after breakfast. As usual, Sticky blazed through all of them. Mr. Benedict subscribed to several, while Rennie and Kate traded sections of the Stonetown Times. Whenever they finished a section, they would pass it to Constance, who glanced at the headlines and drew mustaches and devil horns on people in the photographs. The children were allowed to linger over the papers as long as they wished, but they seldom lingered long, for the older ones looked forward to their exercises and lessons, which offered a welcome change of pace, and Constance ran out of pictures to deface. On this morning, Sticky finished even more quickly than usual, then hustled off to find Number 2, who was letting him use her computer to access the Stonetown Library catalog. He was in the process of memorizing it, had already spent hours scrolling through the records, and today he hoped to finish. It had been tedious work, but it would make his future research more efficient, and Sticky was excited. "I would have thought Mr. Benedict had every book in the world," Kate had said, when Sticky first mentioned his project. "The whole house is crammed with them." "I know," said Sticky, with an eager, appreciative look, "and I still haven't read half of them, but whenever..." "You've read half of them?" Kate cried. But Sticky was just gaining steam. "But whenever a bibliography mentions a book that Mr. Benedict doesn't have, there's nothing to do but request it from the library, right? And if the Stonetown library system doesn't have it, then I have to ask for an interlibrary loan, which means filling out a different form altogether. So think of how much faster the process will be when I can skip the catalog and go straight to the appropriate form. I'll still have to wait until errand day to get the books, of course, but it's much... Naturally, said Kate, who hadn't really been listening. But let me just be clear. You've read half the books in this house? This whole house? Well, approximately half, Sticky said. To be more accurate, I suppose, I read more like... His eyes went up as he calculated. 3/7? Yeah, 3/7. Only 3/7, said Kate, pretending to look disappointed. And here I was prepared to be impressed. After Sticky had gone out, Kate and Rennie discussed the newspaper articles they had read, almost all of which were about Stonetown having fallen on hard times. The city's government bureaucracy was terribly snarled, its budget a wreck. And what Kate and Rennie knew that most readers could not know, because the information was still classified, was that La Drop the Curtain was much to blame. I used to think the emergency was boring to read about, Kate observed. But at least it was dramatic. This is just a tiresome mess. Sometimes I wonder if they'll ever get it straightened out. Rennie had wondered this himself. After all, more than a year had passed since the Whisperer had stopped sending messages into the minds of the public. No longer was Mr. Curtin secretly creating the fearful, confused, desperate atmosphere known as the emergency. And according to Mr. Benedict, the mental effects of those messages had almost entirely disappeared. And yet, Stonetown, one of the world's most important cities, was having difficulty paying its own bills and cleaning its own streets. Mental effects were one thing, Mr. Benedict had said, and practical effects quite another. Rennie shrugged. Mr. Benedict says it could take a long time. He says it's hard to fix a problem when so few people know the cause. That's what's irritating about it, Kate said, the fact that it's classified. I mean, even most of the people in the government don't know the truth. Milligan says some officials insist on keeping it secret. It's because they're embarrassed, Constance put in, without glancing up from her work. She was busy giving the mayor crossed eyes and insect antennae. They don't want people to know they were duped by Mr. Curtin, just like everyone else. Rennie and Kate looked at her in surprise. Constance rarely paid attention to these newspaper conversations, and when she did, it was usually to complain that they'd said the same things 1,000 times, which was true enough, but they found it impolite of her to mention. I think you're probably right, Rennie said, but I also think Mr. Curtin's spies might have something to do with it. They could be working to keep the information secret. But that's just a guess. I don't know what their motives would be, or even who any of them are. And Mr. Benedict won't ever talk to us about them. And why is that, Rennie? Constance asked, propping her chin on her hand and affecting a look of serious interest. Now Rennie was really suspicious. But before he could ask Constance what she was up to, Miss Paramal entered the room carrying a file folder. She and Rhonda were the children's primary instructors, though all the adults pitched in from time to time, and as she approached the table, her expression was so determined and so resolutely cheerful that Rennie knew she must be coming to work with Constance, or try to, anyway. Yesterday it had been Rhonda's turn, and the day before that it had been Mrs. Washington's, and before that it had been Mucho's. None had had the slightest bit of luck. Constance might labor for hours on tasks of her own choosing, but she positively detested any work assigned to her. "Oh, I'll do those exercises later, Miss Paramal," Constance said before Miss Paramal had even spoken. "Right now I'm discussing the newspaper with Rennie and Kate." A look of understanding passed between Rennie and Kate. Constance must have known Miss Paramal was coming down the hallway. "Is that so?" Miss Paramount said, carefully keeping any hint of disbelief out of her tone. "That's lovely, Constance, but why don't we get these exercises over with? Mr. Benedict designed them especially for you, you know." Constance frowned. "I don't care. They're boring." "But you haven't even looked at them," Miss Paramount said, passing a hand over her fine black hair as if to smooth it. Rennie recognized this as a sign of impatience. He'd often seen her do the same thing when disagreeing with her mother. "I think you'll be surprised." Constance made a gagging sound. Miss Paramount pressed her lips together. "I thought we might do a craft project afterward," she said, after a pause. "Once you finish the exercises, I could show you how to make a sugar cube igloo." Constance looked at her out of the corners of her eyes. "You make the igloo out of sugar cubes?" "Why, yes," Miss Paramount said matter-of-factly. "And you use cake frosting to serve as a sort of glue. You don't eat any of it, of course. It's just for fun." No, of course," said Constance, suppressing a smile. "Bribery," Rennie muttered to Kate, who rolled her eyes. "Well, that sounds great," Constance said, climbing down from her chair. "Let's do the igloo first." Miss Paramount shook her head firmly. "No, Constance. First the exercises, then." "Yes, it's igloo time, Miss Paramount. This'll be fun." She was running for the door, speaking loudly, so as not to hear Miss Paramount's protest. "I'll get the sugar cubes. I know where Mucho hides them." Then she was gone, leaving Miss Paramount to stare bleakly after her. "Nice try, Amma," said Rennie, grinning, and Kate laughed and patted Miss Paramount's arm sympathetically. "I had so hoped that would work," Miss Paramount sighed, absently straightening Rennie's collar. "I admit it was a desperate trick." She forced a smile and moved toward the door. "Mrs. Washington will be in soon to work with you two. Rhonda is assisting Mr. Benedict this morning. And I'm with Constance until lunchtime." "What's for lunch today, Miss Paramount, do you know?" Kate asked. "I hope it's headache medicine," Miss Paramount replied, and went out. Lunch was always an extravagant affair, in part because Mucho Brazos delighted in serving elaborate meals, and in part because lunch and dinner were the only times that all of the house's occupants were together. Even then, Mr. Benedict was often absent, for his work spared few interruptions, and he and Number Two would only pass through, loading plates to carry away. Today, however, everyone was present but Milligan, and as usual, there was much clatter and chatter, as Constance had put it in one of her poems, and tedious talk about what was the matter. The real matter today was Constance herself, but it wasn't discussed until most of the dishes were cleared, and Constance, having failed to grumble her way out of kitchen duty, had trudged out with Miss Paramount and Mucho. "She's only 4, of course," Mr. Benedict was saying, "and barely that. Her lack of interest in these exercises is perfectly understandable. By all rights, she ought to be playing, and I've thought it best not to press her. Still, it seems important to be alert to developments in her abilities, the better to guide her through." "You're quite right," said Mrs. Washington. She turned to her husband. "Haven't we often wished we'd had a better idea of Sticky's gifts when he was that age?" Mr. Washington nodded, which for him constituted a lengthy response, as he was reticent by nature. A slender, bespectacled man, Mr. Washington resembled a taller version of his son, even more so lately, for he'd begun shaving his own head whenever he shaved Sticky's, just as something to do. There were only so many improvement projects he could undertake with so many people in the house, and Mr. Washington, a skilled carpenter, accustomed to hard work, was desperate for activity. "If we had done similar exercises with Sticky," Mrs. Washington continued, her tone suddenly regretful, "perhaps we'd have made fewer mistakes. Don't you think, dear?" Mr. Washington considered this, and then nodded. "We learn from our mistakes, though," said Rhonda mildly, And Sickie has turned out wonderfully well, hasn't he?" Mrs. Washington's face lit up. "Oh, yes, he has. Of course he has," she cried, as Mr. Washington nodded, and both beamed fondly at their son. Their son, meanwhile, squirmed in his seat. These days, almost anything Sticky's parents said about him embarrassed him. They might have said Sticky likes salt on his potatoes, and still he would have winced. But public adoration was more embarrassing by far. It was all he could do not to reach for his spectacles. "We are none of us impervious to error," said Mr. Benedict. "I least of all. It was not so long ago, you'll recall, that I failed to perceive the character of my brother's plottings, to the great detriment of everyone here. So focused was I on protecting the Whisperer, I completely overlooked the possibility of Ladropthus capturing me as a means of reclaiming it. A foolish mistake indeed, and I—" "Mr. Benedict," snapped number two, who, in the midst of peeling an orange, she always followed lunch with a snack, slapped it down with such force that juice squirted across the table into Rennie's eye. "Sorry, sorry," she said, as Mrs. Perrimore handed Rennie a damp napkin. "But I simply cannot bear to hear such talk." Pointing her finger accusingly at Mr. Benedict, number two said, "You spend so little time thinking of yourself that it was a natural mistake. You can't blame yourself for your brother's treachery." Everyone seconded number two's sentiments, but Mr. Benedict, acknowledging this with a grateful inclination of his head, persisted. "Nevertheless, I cannot say too often how deeply I regret the circumstances it has created for you all. I feel that—" Here his speech faltered, and his bright green eyes glistened all the more brightly with tears. Kate discreetly took hold of his teacup, ready to slide it away if Mr. Benedict slumped forward. "But you have said it too often, Mr. Benedict," said Mrs. Perrimore, in an imperious tone that was quite out of character. "And if you continue in this vein, I'm afraid we'll be compelled to cut our visit short. Surely there are other establishments that would host an entire troop of guests indefinitely and without reward, and not feel obliged to apologize for it." For an instant, only Rennie knew that his grandmother was joking. Everyone else sat in startled silence. Then Mr. Benedict erupted into his high-spirited laugh, that peculiar, familiar laugh that sounded so much like a dolphin, and the whole table soon followed suit. Everyone laughed until their eyes watered, especially after Mrs. Perrimore, who at first had succeeded in maintaining her haughty air, finally broke down into giggles herself. Mr. Benedict, having narrowly escaped falling asleep from regret, now came close to doing so from mirth. At last the jollity subsided, and Mr. Benedict removed his spectacles to dab at his eyes with a napkin, saying, "Thank you, Mrs. Perrimore, for lightening the mood. I dare say we all needed that." Resettling the spectacles on his nose, he took out his pocket watch, frowned, and grew businesslike again. "I'm expecting visitors," Mr. Benedict said, "but before they arrive, I must return to Constance a moment. As I said, I do feel compelled to press her a bit, and toward this end, I should like to enlist Rennie, Sticky, and Kate in an experiment. Provided you're willing, of course," he said to the children, "and only with your parents' permission." When Miss Perrimore had been sent for, she hurried in from the kitchen wearing sudsy gloves and a look of relief. Mr. Benedict explained his idea. After a brief discussion, the parents all granted their permission, and the children, somewhat reluctantly, agreed to help. "I'll have to ask Milligan when he gets back," said Kate, whose father had been called away on a secret matter the day before. "Actually, I've already secured his permission," said Mr. Benedict, "but you can discuss it with him later if you like. He's just returned." "He has?" Kate cried, jumping up. Sure enough, they could all hear Milligan whistling in the hallway. He was a supremely talented whistler, and the next moment he burst into the dining room, arms stretched wide in greeting. Kate flew to him happily. She was always relieved when he came home, safe, and he laughed as she hugged him, taking a few steps backward to absorb her momentum, and calling out a cheerful, "Hello, hello," to everyone else. Milligan looked like himself for a change. No disguises, bandages, or casts, and his bright, buoyant aspect, so much like his daughter's, brought smiles to the faces of everyone in the room. A tall man with flaxen blonde hair and ocean blue eyes, the same color as Kate's, Milligan wore a shabby assemblage of boots, jacket, and hat that quite belied his position as a top-secret agent. But agent he was, and no sooner had he greeted them than he drew Mr. Benedict, Rhonda, and Number Two aside to speak in private. Rennie overheard the words, "just as we thought," and "sooner than expected," and noting Mr. Benedict's expression, attentive and composed, yet also faintly troubled, he realized that here, at last, was some kind of important development. But whatever it was, it appeared to be an undesirable one. "If you'll excuse us," Mr. Benedict said, turning to address the table, "my visitors have arrived. Mr. Bain is bringing them up presently." "No, no," he said, when the others made to leave. "Please stay as long as you like. This is an official matter, and must be dealt with in my study." He went out, accompanied by Rhonda, Milligan, and Number Two. Mrs. Paramore murmured something to Mrs. Washington, who shared a questioning glance with her husband. Apparently, Rennie wasn't the only one who had sensed this official matter was significant. "You have half an hour before your afternoon lessons," Mrs. Washington said. "Wouldn't you three like to go outside?" "Actually," said Kate, already moving to the door, "I need the boys' help with something. Don't worry, we'll keep out of everyone's way." She beckoned to Rennie and Sticky, who hurried after her so eagerly that the adults, had they not been intent on having a private discussion themselves, might have been suspicious. The boys followed Kate down the long hallway, past Mr. Benedict's study, thinking they were headed upstairs to talk. To their surprise, however, she turned at the stairs and darted down a seldom-used passage, which, as far as Rennie knew, led to nothing but an overcrowded storage room and a utility closet. "Wait, you really do want help with something?" Sticky asked, as they hustled to catch up. "I assumed you wanted to talk about these mysterious visitors." "We can talk later," said Kate. She opened her bucket and handed each of them an empty water glass that she'd smuggled from the dining room. "Right now we're going to listen." "You mean eavesdrop?" said Rennie, raising his eyebrows. He knew this trick. By putting your ear to a glass and the glass to the wall, you could sometimes make out what was said in the next room. He felt his heartbeat quickening. "But we'll be seen," Sticky objected. "Eavesdropping on an official meeting won't go over very well, you know." "Lower your voice," said Kate, with a glance back down the passage. She drew the boys into the utility closet and shut the door. "Listen," she whispered as she groped for the light switch. "This meeting is obviously unusual. I mean, Mr. Benedict has countless meetings, but you can tell this one is different, can't you?" The light came on. The boys, squinting, nodded. "And chances are we won't be told anything about it, right? It's for our own protection, they'll say, and that's probably true. But aren't you curious? Don't you want to know?" "Of course," Rennie said. "I'm just wondering how you plan to get away with it." Kate looked at Sticky, who was trying not to fidget for fear of knocking over a broom or dust mop. They were rather tightly packed. Cautiously he nodded. "Yes, how do we do it?" "Like so," Kate said with a grin, scooting aside a mop bucket to reveal a large access panel in the wall. She quickly removed its screws, saying, "This old house has been through a lot over the years. Walls knocked down and relocated, plumbing replaced, sockets rewired, you name it. There are lots of what you'd call eccentricities. Here we go now." She lowered the panel to the floor, exposing a tangle of brightly colored insulated wires draped before a dark, empty space, like vines overhanging a cave entrance, Rennie thought, or a bead curtain in a doorway. Kate took out her flashlight, leaving her bucket on the floor nearby. "It's a tight fit," she explained. Sweeping the wires to one side, she shone her flashlight into the darkness, then looked back over her shoulder at the boys. "Don't worry about the wires. They're not connected anymore. Now listen, we need to be as quiet as mice. No, quieter than that. As quiet, dead mice," Rennie suggested. "Perfect," said Kate, with an approving nod. "As quiet as dead mice." And with that, the boys followed Kate into the walls. Through the Listening Glass. Having passed through the curtain of dangling wires, Rennie discovered that he could stand upright in the space between walls. It was narrow, with scarcely room to turn his head, but by edging sideways, as if shuffling along a ledge, he was able to move without bumping the walls. Once or twice, Kate directed her flashlight at the floor, drawing his attention to a spot of uneven footing. Each time, Rennie swiveled his eyes toward Sticky to be sure he had noticed, too. Then he nodded to Kate, and silently they moved on. In this way, they soon arrived at the wall of Mr. Benedict's study, beyond which they could hear the muffled tones of conversation. Ever so quietly and carefully, they raised their water glasses and pressed them to the wall. Rennie heard Number Two's agitated voice, as if from the bottom of a well. "Unannounced? If not for Milligan!" Her words grew indistinct. Rennie pressed his ear to the glass so hard it hurt. "The whole point being to catch you off guard. No, they want—" Mr. Benedict's muted voice came in. "I know, Number Two, but at least we've had the experience of observing their methods. It's instructive, don't you think?" A forceful knock sounded at the door. Through the listening glasses, the banging came like a series of detonations. Rennie jumped, almost dropping his glass, and Kate, using her opposite ear and thus facing him, wrinkled her nose. "One moment, please," called Mr. Benedict, and then in a lower tone, barely audible to the eavesdroppers, he said, "Number Two, you and Milligan had better escort Mr. Bain back down to his post. We don't want—" "Why, hello." This in a louder, cheerful tone as the door was rudely opened. "Yes, please do come straight in. Take those two chairs. Just brush away the crumbs there. Number Two was enjoying a biscuit. Perhaps you'd care for something yourselves? No?" A few more pleasantries on the part of Mr. Benedict, a tense and hushed exchange the eavesdroppers couldn't make out, and the study door closed. Mr. Benedict and Rhonda had been left alone with the two visitors. One of them, Rennie had deduced to be Ms. Argent, a highly placed official who often met with Mr. Benedict, and who was always present when the captured executives were brought to the house for questioning. She was a key figure in the cases involving Mr. Curtin, and Rennie could easily picture her silver hair and pinched features. The other visitor had been introduced as Mr. Covet S. Gaines, a man whose deep, gravelly voice, as perceived through the listening glasses, sounded like the rumblings of a tiger. "Let us cut to the chase," rumbled Mr. Gaines when the door had closed. "Certainly," said Mr. Benedict. "And who is to be chasing whom?"
"What, is that a joke?"
"Perhaps not a very funny one. Please continue."
"Very well. Now let's see, you've thrown me off my track."
"I believe you were about to inform me that you are the head of a new committee, assembled to deal with matters concerning the Whisperer, and that, as such, you have a few questions for me."
"How the devil did you know that?"
Ms. Argent said, "He often knows such things, Mr. Gaines. The best course is not to grow exercised." The iciness in Mr. Gaines's tone was not lost even through the wall.
"I thank you for recommending the best course, Ms. Argent. Perhaps you should leave the way, seeing as you know it so well."
Ms. Argent cleared her throat. "We're here to clarify certain things in Mr. Gaines's mind." "Before you make your final decisions, you mean," said Mr. Benedict. No one said anything about decisions, growled Mr. Gaines. Right now we're talking about facts, and I want all of them. I need to know how this Whisperer works, what powers it, what its connection is to you, everything. Start at the beginning, Benedict. Assume I know nothing. That won't be difficult, said Mr. Benedict, and Rhonda's spurt of laughter was surprisingly clear. She must be standing next to the wall, but she instantly disguised it as a coughing fit as Mr. Benedict pressed on. I mean to say, it won't be difficult to give you the facts. It's everything else that I seem to have trouble conveying. Please, said Miss Argent, just answer Mr. Gaines's questions. Mr. Benedict proceeded to relate the facts. The Whisper, he said, was powered by the tidal turbines his brother had invented and installed in Stonetown Bay. Due to their remarkable design, these turbines were capable of generating enormous energy, a mere fraction of which had once powered Mr. Curtin's institute, but which currently remained unused, save for the energy they transmitted to the Whisper. Transmit? Interjected Mr. Gaines. How? With cables, wires? Speak plainly, Benedict. Forgive me, said Mr. Benedict, and then, making liberal use of terms such as electrical resistance and electromagnetic induction and receiver coils, along with a great many terms that only Sticky, of all the eavesdroppers, even faintly recognized, he explained that the energy was transmitted invisibly, without cables or wires. Is that plain enough, Mr. Gaines? Yes, quite, Mr. Gaines replied after an uncertain silence. Please continue. The Whisperer, continued Mr. Benedict, was modeled after my brother's own brain and was once responsive only to his mental direction. Given the similarities of our brains, I trust you're aware that Ladroptha and I are identical twins, I have managed to induce the Whisperer, with certain modifications, to respond to my own directions as well. But, of course, you will be familiar with all of this from the case files. Rennie felt a tickle at the end of his nose. A spider had descended by a strand of web and settled lightly upon him. In the ambient glow from Kate's flashlight, he could just make out the spider's doubled image, double because his eyes were crossed. And somehow resisting an urge to thrash about in panic, he moved his hand slowly and deliberately to brush it away. Of the original function still in place, Mr. Benedict was saying, when Rennie was able to concentrate again, along with other modifications that have allowed me to aid its victims in recovering their memories. So, as you can see, if the Whisperer were to fall into my brother's hands again, he would be an immediate threat. Not only could he suppress memories, as he has done before with devastating effect, he could retrieve them as well. You mean he could obtain key information, rumbled Mr. Gaines, sensitive information. Precisely. Passwords, codes, any bit of classified material a person might possess. He could have it all at his disposal. He would need only be within range. Miss Argent asked, "And how far exactly would that range extend, Mr. Benedict?" "It is not so much a question of distance as of focus. Ladroptha could use the Whisperer on anyone in his presence, any person toward whom he could direct his full attention." Mr. Gaines said, "So if I were standing, say, in the courtyard outside this house, and he was looking down at me from a window, you would be in range, yes." "And he could, what do you call it, brain sweep me," Mr. Gaines said. "He could wipe away my memories, or extract my memories for his own purposes, essentially read my mind." "Yes." "And if there were a whole crowd of people in that courtyard?" "In theory, they would all be at risk," said Mr. Benedict. "Though in reality, perhaps not. The Whisperer responds only to very specific, very powerful mental direction, and the concentration required to use it is exhausting. My brother has a fierce mind and could certainly do a great deal of damage, but he is human, after all. He would need to rest." "You keep saying your brother," said Mr. Gaines slowly, But what about you, Benedict? The Whisperer responds to your mental direction, too. So couldn't, in theory, I mean, couldn't you do all those things we've just mentioned? In theory, yes. But he wouldn't, Rhonda cried. Mr. Gaines's demanding tone had become conciliatory now, almost ingratiating. Oh, no, I never meant to imply Mr. Benedict would use the Whisperer for the wrong reasons. But if it were for a higher purpose, I mean, for the good. Take, for example, these captured former executives. Your questioning of them has produced no useful information. On the contrary, said Mr. Benedict, I have found it helpful indeed. No offense, but the committee has deemed that information useless, said Mr. Gaines. Psychological motives and personal foibles aren't exactly facts, you know. Or perhaps you don't. Well, let's not argue, Benedict. The point is, with the Whisperer, you could find out more definite things, could you not? Secret information that would lead us to your brother. I doubt it, said Mr. Benedict. LaDropha has never trusted even his closest assistants to keep his most guarded secrets. He chooses instead to spread information around selectively and to season it with red herrings. By red herrings, I mean false leads. I know what a red... I may have misinterpreted your look of confusion, Mr. Benedict said quickly. Perhaps you simply don't understand my position. So let me be clear. I will not use the Whisperer on anyone. Anyone, Mr. Gaines, against that person's will. It is an intrusion, a violation. One's mind is one's most valuable private possession. I would no sooner break into your memories, Mr. Gaines, than I would break into your home. We are not talking about me, protested Mr. Gaines. We're talking about criminals, Benedict. Listen, I can understand your hesitation with these executives. I've read your arguments about how they were captured as children and raised up under Curtin's influence, how they should therefore be shown some lenience, even forgiveness, and so on. But leaving them aside, I don't see how you could refuse to probe the minds of these wicked fellows who worked for Curtin, these, what do you call them? These elegant thugs your man Milligan has brought in. The agents call them 10 men, said Miss Argent, because they have 10 different ways to hurt you. Right. These unsavory 10 men. Nothing they've said has helped us get one step closer to your brother. In point of fact, they've hardly said anything at all. Nor will they, said Mr. Benedict, not so long as they perceive any chance of LaDropha gaining power. So you admit it. You admit your brother may yet be seeking a way to gain power? But you won't use the Whisperer on these vicious? Tell me, Mr. Gaines, have you ever spoken with Milligan about the years of crushing sadness he endured because of the Whisperer's effects? Or the mental anguish he experienced while trying to resist being brain-swept in the first place? I don't need to speak to Milligan about it. His is a different case entirely. In this case, couldn't you? I have nothing further to say on this matter, Mr. Gaines. There was a long pause during which the eavesdroppers strove to keep still and quiet. Sticky was especially tormented. His natural fidgetiness was at its peak in moments like this, but the others were struggling too. In Kate, the reminder of those lonely years she and Milligan had lived apart had stoked an old, low-burning anger, and she felt like running, jumping, climbing, fighting, anything to work off the emotion. And Rennie, as he often did when his mind was racing, felt a powerful urge to pace. Instead, the three of them stood frozen, ears to their listening glasses, waiting. At length, Miss Argent broke the silence. In a tentative voice, as if she herself didn't much like what she was about, she said, "What about your new side project, Mr. Benedict? Don't you wish to pursue that work?" "What new project?" asked Mr. Gaines. "Why am I just hearing of this?" "Mr. Benedict believes the Whisperer might be used to alleviate the symptoms of his narcolepsy, by way of a kind of hypnosis, Is that right, Mr. Benedict? A sort of fooling of the brain's habitual responses to stimuli.
I'm impressed, Miss Argent, said Mr. Benedict, in an amiable tone. Rennie imagined him tapping his nose, as he often did when someone gave a correct answer.
You remember perfectly something I never mentioned to you.
I'm sorry, that's quite all right. I've made no real secret of my project, and it does interest me to see how information travels.
We're offering you a deal, said Mr. Gaines, having instantly latched on to Miss Argent's implied suggestion and making it his own. You can get rid of your narcolepsy, or whatever you call it, and in the meantime you'll use the whisper as we see fit. That's a fair trade, Benedict. You know it is.
I know nothing of the kind. It was not just my own situation I hoped to improve, Mr. Gaines, but that of countless people with similar conditions, since it stands to reason that what works on me might work on others. Regardless, I am not sure my ideas are even practicable. To determine that would require considerable research and experiment. But even if I were sure, Mr. Gaines, we would have no deal, for I simply will not do what you ask of me.
I guess you like falling asleep willy-nilly, said Mr. Gaines angrily.
I certainly prefer it to laying aside my moral concerns.
Very well, said Mr. Gaines, and there was a harsh scraping sound as he rose abruptly from his chair. You leave us no choice. We're taking the Whisperer. There's no longer any justification for you to have it here. You've already restored all the memories that your brother...
Not all of them, Mr. Benedict corrected.
Mr. Gaines snorted. Do spare me your pointless distinctions. The captured executives had their chance and refused it. If they don't trust you, what do you expect me to...
I wasn't referring to the captured executives.
Well, I'm afraid I can't begin to care, Mr. Gaines snapped. Your time is over, Benedict. The whisper is to be moved, and don't try to argue that you're the only one who can use it. All of our top scientific advisors are being assembled right here in Stonetown next week to deal with this very matter.
That was not the argument I intended to raise, said Mr. Benedict calmly. I'm sure you'll do everything you can to find a way to use the Whisperer. And I do worry about the choices you'll make if you succeed. But my more immediate concern is that you'll lose possession of it altogether. If you transport the Whisperer, you expose it. You make it vulnerable.
A weak argument, Benedict. We have our top security people involved. No, I'm afraid the greater risk, as the committee sees it, would be to leave such a powerful tool in the hands of someone who refuses to heed our directions. There is growing concern that we cannot trust you any more. Mr. Gaines made a disgusted sound. Miss Argent, if you please, stop looking so horrified. He wants us to be frightened, the better to protect his position. Now then, Benedict, should you choose to cooperate, you'll be allowed to supervise the removal of the Whisperer and its computers from the premises. We would welcome your technical input, and a good-faith effort on your part might help repair some of your damaged credibility.
And if I choose not to cooperate, Mr. Benedict asked,
then you'll be required to remain in your study throughout the removal process.
I see, said Mr. Benedict.
And when is the removal to take place?
This very evening, said Mr. Gaines. I have the paperwork right.
Well, where the devil is it?
You've mislaid the papers, Mr. Benedict said.
But, Mr. Gaines, you know you cannot take action in my home without proper authorization.
I had it right. What's happened, Miss Argent?
Did I not have it right here with these other...
Forgive us, said Miss Argent. Obviously, we'll need to find these papers, or else have them run through committee again. If that's the case, it will be some time before we can proceed.
Very well, Miss Argent. I thank you, said Mr. Benedict. Now, if you'll excuse us, Rhonda and I must return to work. Milligan is waiting outside the door to show you down.
Mr. Gaines spluttered indignantly.
I'm not leaving until I've... "Actually, you'll be leaving right now," said Rhonda. Whereupon the study door opened, and Milligan's voice, quite cheerful and polite, yet managing at the same time to suggest how unwise it would be to contradict him, said, "If you'll be so kind as to follow me, sir, this is your best opportunity to exit without conflict." "Please, Mr. Gaines, let's go," said Miss Argent. With a snort and a few muttered protests, Mr. Gaines stalked from the room, followed by a silent Miss Argent. The study door closed. "Rhonda," said Mr. Benedict after a pause, "when they've gone, please ask Milligan to bring those papers up. We'll want to look them over. Number two should come as well."
"Of course. But, Mr. Benedict, can it really be that—"
"Before we continue, Rhonda, I must ask another favor. Would you also fetch Rennie, Sticky, and Kate? Escort them all the way here, please. I want no one to speak with them before I've had a chance to do so myself."
"Certainly," Rhonda said. "I'll tell the others and then go find them."
"Oh, finding them won't be necessary," said Mr. Benedict, and Rennie heard a tapping sound inches from his ear. "They're right behind this wall." The eavesdroppers were feeling grateful it was Rhonda who'd been sent to escort them, Rhonda's sternness being tempered somewhat by her amusement. When they discovered Number Two and Constance waiting for them outside the study, both wore expressions of furious disapproval.
"Eavesdropping," Number Two hissed, crossing her arms.
"Without me," Constance said, doing the same. Milligan came along the hallway behind them, playfully tapping Kate on the head with a bundle of papers. He said, "This is hardly appropriate behavior, young lady. Spies have rules, you know."
"Milligan, tell me you aren't making light of this," said Number Two.
"Absolutely not," said Milligan, ambiguously, with a wink at the children. Mr. Benedict opened his door and smiled at the crowd gathered in the hallway. "Won't you all come in, or must I stand at the wall with a glass?" As everyone got settled, those without chairs sat amid piles of books on the floor. Milligan remained standing near the door, and Number Two hovered beside Mr. Benedict, who leaned against his book-cluttered desk. The older children fumbled to explain themselves. Mr. Benedict waved them silent. "I haven't called you in here to apologize," he said, "though it is rather bad form to eavesdrop on your friends. In the future, you must please bear that in mind." He held up the papers Milligan had given him. "This business is what I mean to discuss. What you three heard is far more important at the moment than how you came to hear it."
"And what was that?" Constance demanded. "Why am I always the last to know?"
"In this case," said Mr. Benedict, glancing through the papers as he spoke, "I believe it's because you were in the kitchen pretending to help clean up. Rennie, would you kindly summarize my conversation with Mr. Gaines and Miss Argent? Milligan and Number Two need the details as well. In the meantime, Rhonda, please memorize the names on these forms. Milligan and Number Two will already have done so, and then destroy them." As Rennie sheepishly related the details of the conversation, Rhonda flipped through the papers with a keen eye. She had an excellent memory, almost as good as Sticky's. And in the few short minutes it took Rennie to give his account, she finished her task, shredded the papers, and took a seat on the floor next to Kate. "An excellent summary, Rennie," said Mr. Benedict. "Thank you. Now I believe Constance has some questions." But Constance had already butted in, crying, "How did you know they were eavesdropping, Mr. Benedict? Why didn't you send them away? It isn't fair. And is this true about using the whisper to get rid of your narcolepsy? How could it do that? And how dare they think they can take it away from you? Who do they think they are?" The little girl, her pudgy cheeks gone quite crimson with the heat of her emotions, seemed unable to decide whether to be envious, outraged, hopeful, or worried. And in her agitation, she wasn't getting answers quickly enough to suit her, though she hadn't allowed time for Mr. Benedict to respond. She began to repeat her questions from the beginning. Mr. Benedict held up his hands until she fell silent. "Let me answer your questions in order, my dear. First, I have used this study for so many years. Any shift in acoustics, I mean the way sound carries, is bound to draw my attention. But by the time I realized that the hollow space in the wall behind me was no longer quite so hollow, it was too late to send away the wicked spies. He smiled at the spies in question, without calling Mr. Gaines's attention to their presence. That would not do, you see, for it would subject them to all sorts of disagreeable inquiries, and no doubt the Washingtons and Piramals would be dragged in as well. As for using the whisper to diminish the symptoms of my narcolepsy, what I told Mr. Gaines was the truth. It's possible. My hope was to adapt the machine to transmit powerful messages, instructions essentially, that could redirect certain faulty mental impulses. Whenever my brain, for instance, sent a signal to fall asleep at inappropriate moments, these new, more powerful instructions would be to ignore the signal. Basically a form of hypnosis, said Sticky, and Mr. Benedict tapped his nose. And you thought it might work on others as well, Rennie said, not a little wonderingly, for the real potential of Mr. Benedict's project was only just now sinking in. That would mean thousands of people. No, even more than that. Why, millions of people might be helped. Mr. Benedict nodded. You see why I thought it worth pursuing, even though my chances of success were slim at best. And your nightmares, Constance persisted? The old hag and those other terrible hallucinations? Would it take care of those things, too? Again, it's possible, Mr. Benedict said. Indeed, a great many things were possible. Possible, if not probable. I even entertained some small hope of using this project to persuade my brother to surrender. Under the right circumstances, if LaDropthe found himself in a terrible spot, with no good options before him, well, I thought the promise of relief might just draw him in the right direction, a less desperate and thus more peaceful one. But, as I say, my research had only just begun, and now... Well, get to it, Constance cried. You have a little time, right? Or even more if Milligan snatches their papers again. That trick isn't likely to work twice, said Mr. Benedict. At any rate, we cannot afford to dwell on those possibilities now, however grand they might have been to contemplate. The situation has changed, my dear. There is no more time. Our concern now must be what we know the Whisperer can do if it falls into the wrong hands. Gaines's hands are the wrong ones, I can verify that, said Milligan. He doesn't seem to be a spy for Curtin, but he has a lot of power and no judgment. A bad combination, said Number Two. He might as well be a spy, said Rhonda. If he succeeds in getting the Whisperer removed, he's doing exactly what Curtin would want. Because taking it out into the open makes it vulnerable, said Kate, remembering what Mr. Benedict had said earlier. Yes, said Rhonda. When we first moved the Whisperer here, right after your mission to the Institute, Curtin was on the run and could do nothing to intercept us. He's had time to prepare now, though. He has spies, and he most certainly has a plan. I've been pressed to move the Whisperer before, said Mr. Benedict. Usually the Monk Building is suggested as a preferable location. As you know, I've maintained an office there for reasons only those of us in this house are aware of, and the government has offered to secure additional space in the building for me. But it has been clear for some time that their real aim is to separate me from the Whisperer. They've tried to use quiet measures, small steps. Now that those have failed, they are prepared to take more extreme action. Who is they? Said Constance. Certain well-placed officials, said Mr. Benedict. Some are likely spies for my brother, seeking a way to return his Whisperer to him. Others are more interested in seeing what they can do with it themselves. And still others, such as poor Miss Argent, are hapless individuals caught up in the process, trying to do their jobs, uncertain where their loyalty should lie, and not quite up to the task of deciding.
"So what do we do now?" asked Kate.
"Your lessons," said number two, checking her watch. The older children cried out in protest, and Constance wrapped her arms tightly